Case number 14-5039, Catherine Sack, appellant versus United States Department of Defense. Mr. McClanahan for the appellant, Mr. Mayer for the appellee.
Please proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Apologies, I'm coming in over a cold, so I may cough periodically during this. Your Honors, this case involves a few issues that do not easily resolve themselves to quick discussion, and each topic has to be discussed separately from the other topics in order to really understand it, except for the severance and relatedness issues. So that being said, I apologize if I do skip around a bit in order to hit points that I think are most important for the court to hear.
Can we dispose of two quick issues? You mentioned severance.
Yes, sir.
But, have you read the district court's order? What you call the severance order.
I have read it, yes.
He says the claims against these agencies are dismissed. He doesn't say anything about severance. He says they're dismissed without prejudice. And then he says, to the extent the plaintiff wishes to proceed with these, plaintiffs shall refile the claims in four separate lawsuits. So he didn't sever. He dismissed the complaints. And he did that in what you call... he did that in SAC 2, and this is SAC 2A, so we don't have jurisdiction over that order.
I respectfully disagree,
okay,
Your Honor.
Okay, tell me why.
Well, first of all, even though he did use the words, I dismiss these claims, mm-hmm. he did it by granting the agency's motion to sever.
Yeah, but he dismissed the complaint and ordered them to file new lawsuits.
And that's my second point, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. That is... in my experience, an unusual method of severing cases. Most judges in response to a motion to sever the cases. The fact that he chose, whether intentionally or unintentionally, whether or not he meant this consequence, we don't know. But the fact that he chose to dismiss them and order them to be refiled.
Except for what he says.
All we know from what he says is that he is removing those counts from the complaint with orders.
And further order, he says, I know you said you didn't want to spend much time on this, but he says they're dismissed without prejudice. That's one word or one reference. Sounds like dismissal to me. And then he says, to the extent plaintiffs wish to file a new, they must file a new claim in four separate lawsuits. And then he even goes so far as to say, to note on the new cases, that they're related cases. So
right.
That's all the language of dismissal in a different case than is the one before us.
I think this is a case of if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, then it's a duck. And the fact that he did this in response to a motion to sever.
This duck looks like a dismissal to me, but go ahead.
And he did this based on a motion to sever. The entire discussion during the motion hearing,
okay.
which he said were in for the reasons in the hearing we had
okay.
today,
well,
were severed.
Why don't you go on to your other issues, because I don't know what else we can say about that.
Okay.
I'll ask the government what it thinks.
And so, I mean, if I can show just... Yeah. Say one more thing on that,
sure.
if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Even the fact that he did that does not change the fact that, you know, Wright and Miller, the horn book on this, says that creation of separate cases leads to final judgment upon complete disposition of any single case. Mm-hmm. That doesn't say leads to final judgment for each single case upon final disposition of that case. It says final judgment period upon a severance, and whether or not he called a severance a dismissal, I think is a distinction without a difference. To the point of whether or not it should have been severed, well, do you wish to discuss the merits of severance?
It's your time. That was your time. Whatever you like.
Okay. Well, we've really argued in our brief to death the argument of whether or not it should have been severed. And so unless the court has any questions about that, we'll skip to one of the other issues. Although we will point out two things that are just the hallmark examples of why these should not have been severed and they should have been related. And that is the fact that one of them, as an example, the OPM request, was one request that parts of the same documents got referred to different agencies. And according to his order, we now have to litigate the same document in two different cases, in three different counts. That's what we warned him about in the beginning, and he didn't take that into consideration. The second is that he did talk about the procedural postures. He spent a lot of time talking about the procedural postures, warranted severance, and then he severed them according to agency with no attention being paid to the different procedural postures. If he had really cared about the different procedural postures, he would have directed us to file all the ones that were still being searched in one case, all of ones that were charging exemptions in another case, all the ones that we had fees in another case, instead of saying DOD, DOJ, CIA. That division itself shows that he did not care about procedural postures. To the NSA issue, there are two issues in play in the NSA case. One is whether or not she was entitled to be considered an educational fee requester. This is really simple, we think. This is her supervisor, the director of graduate studies, not just an adjunct professor or something, said, I endorse the fact that she is making this request on behalf of this department and furtherance of the research goals of this department.
Couldn't every professor for every student request around the country do the same?
Yes, honestly, and I don't see a problem with that because that's an issue between the student and the professor. If the professor is willing to put his name on something saying, for all intents and purposes, you can treat this as a request from me, then who is the agency to second guess that?
That does seem an end run around the line drawn by at least the guidelines, not the statute itself, in terms of students versus professors.
It's an end run only in that you would consider that to be a rule. That was, first of all, a guideline, a suggestion. And it was paired with the argument that if you receive something from a professor, he's an educational requester unless you prove otherwise. And so it's an end run, but it's a perfectly legitimate and legal end run. It's something that, given that the purpose of FOIA and the purpose of the educational fee category is to foster research, it's quibbling over technicality.
The statute, the text, if we go to the statute, the set of guidelines is made by an educational institution.
And not made by a professor. So by that statute, even a professor couldn't do it. You would have to say, I am the University of Virginia.
Don't the OMB guidelines say there's no meaningful distinction between professor and student in this setting?
They do say, for instance, something from a professor should be presumed to be from
I'm reading the institutional versus individual test would apply to student requests as well. So student requests can be on behalf of an educational institution.
I would say yes, but I don't think we even need to get to that in this case. I think that, honestly, a request from a PhD candidate who is doing research for the PhD program.
You think the letter from Jeffrey Jenkins is the persuasive?
More than persuasive. And NSA's insistence that, I did not find it supportable because it wasn't from the department chair, is a test found nowhere in any statute or any guideline or any reg.
What about the guideline says a student who makes a request in furtherance of the completion of the course of instruction is carrying out an individual research goal and the request would not qualify? So if it were just the student here, and if we follow that guideline, no good.
Absent the letter.
The question is, can universities, educational institutions, in essence, get around that by having their professors endorse their student requests as being on behalf of the institution in some respects, even though they're really student requests?
They could.
That seems to be what was concerning the district court judge.
But that, again, is beyond the scope of the district court judge's review, I believe. And my time is about to end,
so can
I continue my
answer? Don't worry about your time.
Our point here is, yes, and it's akin to the idea of if my law clerk, who is not a lawyer, writes a brief, can I add my imprimatur on it and file it with you so that you see it? The answer is, yes, I have accepted her brief as my own. That's what these professors are doing. If it turns out that a university has a policy of just every student request gets a letter of endorsement from a professor, then that's an issue that the agency might want to pursue against that school or something. But that is not the case here. This was an individualized endorsement where he said, you may treat this request as a request from any of the faculty members in this department.
I'm just concerned reading the statute. Obviously, one thing Congress could have done and could do is to say, requests by students get fee waivers. That would have been very simple and not quite as game of statutory language. But Congress didn't do that. It said requests by or made by an educational institution, which seems distinct from requests by students. I'm trying to thread that needle is what is concerning me here and concerning the district court judge, too. I think it's a close call, though.
And the OMB, well, this comes to another question of the OMB guidelines were not written by Congress. They were written by a bunch of lawyers interpreting something Congress wrote and, in many cases, such as this, injecting their own impression.
Wait a second. You're arguing against the persuasiveness of the OMB guidelines? I thought that was your best argument, the OMB guidelines, because they don't distinguish between professors and students.
The OMB guidelines do distinguish between professors and students. I think that the OMB...
Okay, if you want to abandon them, that's fine.
No, my point is that the OMB guidelines, I don't think you should give them the imprimatur of what Congress intended. But if you do, then you should pay close attention to the fact that they do say a student is presumed not to be and a professor is presumed to be, which means a professor who endorses a student, it falls under the professor category, not the student category.
Well, I want to make sure I understand the precise argument you're making about the letter. As I understand what you're saying in your brief, the Jenkins letter, which says this verifies that tax FOIA request falls under the category, right? That sentence, that's enough, right? And the university, the agency can't look beyond that. And because that's what you say in your brief, right? It's not the place of an agency to second-guess the intentions of a single faculty member who states unequivocally that it's on behalf of a faculty member, right?
It was not that simple. It did lay out this is in furtherance of the University of Virginia.
The question I'm asking you is that, is I understood your argument, it is that an unequivocal certification by a faculty member can't be second-guessed by the agency, right? There's nothing, you're not depending on anything else in this letter. Right?
I'm going to take one step short of that because...
Well, you have to stick with your brief.
I know,
okay,
but...
so go ahead.
An unequivocal endorsement from a faculty member should be treated as a request from that faculty member. Just like any faculty member can still be denied educational standing if he's getting it to further his own real estate holdings.
All right.
It should be evaluated under the presumption that it is legitimate. And since that presumption is
that's a different argument now. If it's a presumption can be questioned. I thought your position was, and I'm reading from your brief, it is not the place of an agency or a court to second-guess the intentions of a single faculty member who states unequivocally that this is on behalf of the institution. It does not matter why the faculty member granted such authorization. That's from your brief.
It is not for the court to second-guess his intention as to whether or not he truly meant to endorse it. The request should still be treated as any other faculty member. To do otherwise would be to say that a student who got a faculty member's endorsement would be able to get an educational fee category where that same faculty member on his own could not.
So does that mean that the agency can look at the content of the letter? So is there, in your view then, is it the statement by the professor that this is meets the standards of the educational exemption, or is it that plus the content of the letter?
It's only the content of the letter. Well, it's partially, I mean, if he just gave, I endorse this, and it was a one-line statement, okay. You could argue that it would have...
Where do you argue in your brief that there's something else in this letter that makes it clear that it's...
Well, when we quote the letter, and the letter was...
I know you quote the letter, but where do you argue that there's something in this letter that makes it clear that this particular research she is doing... I mean, I think you could make the argument looking at the letter, but where do you make it?
I make it, if you give me one second.
Yeah, just tell me, and I'll look at it.
Where's the... page 9 of the reply.
Yeah, the reply brief. I found that, too. But what about the blue brief?
Oh, okay. That would be... Sorry. Mm-hmm. You found the right section. We implied it. I'll be honest about that. We didn't come out and say...
In your reply brief, you sort of make the point at the end. You say, the DOD ignores a simple fact that a significant percentage of research performed by educational institutions is performed by PhD students.
Correct.
There's nothing like that in the blue brief.
Correct.
Okay, so that's not an argument that's properly before us. Right? You understand that?
Pardon me?
That's not an argument, then, that's properly before us, right? You can't raise new arguments in a reply brief.
That was more for context than argument, honestly. But to answer your question of should it be a presumption versus should it be a requirement, I can just quote the OMB guidelines for what a professor is. A request from a professor of geology at a state university for records relating to soil erosion written on letterhead of the Department of Geology could be presumed to be from an educational institution. So we're saying, and all we're saying is that a letter from a professor on university letterhead adopting as his own a student.
Thanks. We're way over your time.
Okay. Thank you, Your
Honor. Give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Mayer, counsel for the United States government here at the Department of Defense. I'd like to begin by addressing the issue that the court was discussing with my opponent. That is the fee waiver issue. That is, as Judge Kavanaugh, your question pointed out, a close question. That's how Judge Wilkins characterized it too. And I think it's really the only close question that this case presents. Notwithstanding the fact that it may be a close question and it's fact-intensive, I think the agency got it correct, and I think the district court got it correct.
What was deficient in the response? DOD asked for certain representations about the nature of the request, and the May 12, 2011 letter was responsive to it. If you're just looking at that letter as a response to what DOD asked, what's deficient in the letter?
I think the primary deficiency, Judge Griffith, is the absence of anything in the letter that disabuses the agency of the notion that this is a FOIA request in support of the student's personal research in fulfillment of coursework and not something that's supporting faculty research, which is the research of the institution. Let me...
Wait a second. Is that always the case, that research by a doctoral candidate doesn't have the status of research by faculty?
No,
I think, as a matter of fact, that's not the case.
No, the emphasis...
And the OMB guidelines make clear that that's not the case, right?
I agree.
Yeah, there's no categorical difference between in the request between a student and a faculty member, according to the OMB guidelines.
No, that's right. Right. I guess the point that I want to emphasize is this. I think the dichotomy in the guidelines is a dichotomy between work that's being done by the student in fulfillment of course requirements and work that's being done by the faculty. Keep in mind that the guidelines and the educational institution isn't confined
but
to institutions
of... But you've got the university here saying it's for us, right? Isn't that what the letter says? You've got the deputy associate director for... No, I'm sorry. You've got the associate professor and director of graduate studies saying, this is for us. She's doing this for us. Why isn't that enough? Why in the world do we get into this questioning of what Professor Jenkins is saying? Why isn't that sufficient?
What
As I read it, that's exactly what DOD asked. They asked for something to show that it's coming from the university. The university says, yep, this is research we're interested in. She's doing it for us. Why isn't that the end of the
I argument? Understand that's the position that the plaintiff has taken this morning. I don't believe that the guidelines are indicating that merely a rubber stamp by any faculty member of a student request makes the request one on behalf of the institution.
It's a rubber stamp. He writes, Ms. Sack is acting as a representative of the University of Virginia's Department of Politics, and you may consider the department to be the requester for purposes of fee calculations. Do you call that a rubber stamp?
I do.
Well, wait. The letter goes beyond that. It actually explains the point that Judge Griffith just read you. It actually explains what the mission of the department is, and then it explains how her work, it's obvious that what she's doing conforms to that mission.
Right.
Well,
it says it right in the letter.
Judge Tatel, there's really no way that you could characterize any student research as being inconsistent
explaining it. He says, let me just find my notes here. Jenkins says he describes the goals of his department, and they are, quote, to explain contemporary political in a broad philosophical, you see that sentence? Mm-hmm. That sheds light on the long-term development of institutional structures, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the next sentence says that the student intends to review, evaluate, and synthesize and present all this information publicly, accessible, publicly available, usable form. I don't think DOD has any idea how graduate departments work. You have departments that often have substantive missions like this one, and they have PhD graduate students doing coursework, and that coursework is carefully structured to promote the goals of the department. That's the way many graduate programs work.
This isn't a student doing a book report and asking for help from FOIA. This is scholarly research, and the University of Virginia has stood behind it. Why in the world is the Department of Defense second-guessing that? What's the worry here?
The worry, Judge Griffith, is only in terms of conformity with the purpose of the statute, which is
and
to...
And in this instance, it's supposed to be broadly construed, right?
Which is
generously construed.
That's true.
Yeah.
But it isn't a statute that gives a fee waiver to everyone. And it's not a statute that gives...
But it's a statute that gives a fee waiver to everyone where the university says, this is for us. Now, if you want to get behind that and depose Mr. Jenkins, I guess we could go down that path, but that doesn't seem to be consistent with the statute or our case law.
One point I think I need to make, Your Honor, is this. The agency's decision, I don't think, is confined to that letter. It also includes the prior representations that the requester made, okay? It has to take a holistic approach to all of this. If there is a central point that I want to make, it is that requests that are for the university, for a faculty member or a request for an educational institution. Request by a student.
Wait a second. It doesn't need to be for a faculty member. That's a really important point. It can be a request for a student. The OMB, at least according to the OMB guidelines, there's no categorical difference between faculty and student. It's the nature of the research and who's going to benefit from it, right?
Well, the point that I wanted to make, Judge Griffith, is that it can't be a request designed to permit the student to fulfill the requirements of his course. Okay?
You're saying if it has that as one feature of it, it's disqualified?
But if that's the only feature of it,
right?
I think it's important here that the requester never disavowed the proposition that the request was in fulfillment of her coursework.
But in fulfillment of coursework that promotes the goals of the department.
Judge Tandley, if that's the standard, keep in mind that the educational institution definition isn't confined to institutions of higher learning. It also includes secondary schools. It also includes middle schools.
And how many middle schools are doing scholarly research? That's absurd.
I think not, Judge Griffith. If this position is right, any student in a middle school or a secondary school who wants to do research in fulfillment of their course requirements would be entitled to a fee waiver the research would be in support of the educational institution.
And fulfillment of course work is disqualifying, regardless of the benefit that might accrue to the university of it. You phrase it, if it's in fulfillment of coursework, you think that's automatically disqualifying?
Yes, I do.
And what's the basis for that in the statute or the regulations?
I believe that's the difference between an educational institution and the students who attend it.
And the question to me is not necessarily what's in the letter specifically, but there's a broader legal question here, which is PhD students or college students who send requests, are those going to be deemed requests by the educational institution if a faculty member says as much?
Well, one thing...
And that's the question here, the fork in the road we have, and I'm not sure we have a... I still think it's very close whether that's on behalf of the educational institution, but that seems to me the broad legal question.
I think that's right. There is one factual point that the agency relied on that we haven't discussed this morning, and that is that the faculty member who endorsed this was not the faculty member who was the chairman of the department.
That's a point in your favor, but I don't know that we should turn the case on that, because the point is the next time they'll just get the department head. It'll be easy enough. This is not...
Director of Graduate Studies. I mean, that's a pretty significant position.
Your concern, as I understand it, is that this will become common practice for student FOIA requests, and I assume they make a lot of FOIA requests. You just get the cover letter from the faculty member, and all of a sudden you have the fee waiver, which may be great policy, actually. I'm surprised there isn't a student fee waiver in the statute. The question is whether we can consider that made by the educational institution.
Well, there's a practical concern that I think
how often does this arise, by the way? Do we have any idea of how...
There's nothing in the record that suggests that.
I know, outside the record, you know?
Not to my knowledge, Judge Kavanaugh.
But how many do you get from middle school students?
Hasn't the president issued an executive order requiring agencies to interpret FOIA to promote its goals?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wouldn't it make an enormous amount of sense to interpret this statute to encourage, to maximize the opportunity of students in their coursework to seek government information to write their papers?
Your Honor, I just don't
understand the government's position in this case. It seems completely counterintuitive when you think about the goals of FOIA and the purposes of education. It just makes no sense to me.
It's a line-drawing exercise, Judge Tatel.
Whole point. I don't understand why the line has been drawn where it is, given the goals of FOIA.
Because the pie is limited. The pie is limited in terms of whom you can provide waivers for FOIA request research.
You may end up winning here, because I'm not sure, as I explored with Mr. McClanahan, that he's really made the argument that here, but... I have to say, I just don't get the government's position. And let me ask you about another issue. What about the two hours of time and 100 pages? Why couldn't the agency have just said, okay, you don't want to make the commitment, you get 2 hours and 100 pages, and we'll stop?
Because the regulations, and it's not just the regulations of the Department of Defense, Judge Tatel, but, for example, DOJ's regulations say the same thing. Yeah. Before the agency conducts the search, there has to be an agreement with respect to the to how the search fees are going to be handled. Yeah. Absent that agreement...
But there's no fee for the first 2 hours or 100 pages. So you say, okay, you're not. I just don't understand why this ends up in this court. It just seems to me to be so simple for the agency to have said in its letter, you're not making the commitment, so you get your 2 hours. That's it.
The agency,
what would be the problem with that?
The agency could have, I suppose, conceded...
Wouldn't that have been a lot cheaper than bringing this here?
We're not the appellate, Your Honor.
Yeah.
We didn't bring the suit.
Well, but if you'd done it, you wouldn't have this lawsuit.
I suppose you can say that on a lot of issues in which the government takes a position.
Okay.
So. In terms of your policy, you're trying to figure out what it made by an educational institution means, right?
Right.
And I assume the reason for the government's policy is you're not sure that every student is the educational institution.
The thought that I'd like to leave you with on this question is this. If the rule basically is that it's a request from an educational institution, if it comes from a student, and there is a faculty member who says, this student's request is one that is made on behalf of the educational institution, there are no disincentives for any faculty member not to endorse that request.
Why not go even broader and say just every student request shall be deemed by the educational institution?
I don't understand your question. You say, why wouldn't faculty members or university...
Why go broader and just say, this sham of having a faculty member, sham's a loaded word, but this procedure of the faculty member writing a letter, why don't we just do away with that ridiculous paperwork and just say every student request is a request by the educational institution?
I'd vote for that. You got my vote.
What's wrong with that?
It's a policy question, Your Honor. It seems to me that...
If it's a policy question, you're going to lose. I think your answer should be it's a legal question.
Right.
The legal question is a reflection of a policy determination. That's what I'm saying.
And what do you think Congress's policy determination was in choosing the term made by an educational institution?
I think it was on the basis of a determination that fees should be waived when they are made on behalf of a school.
What do you think they were thinking about when they said, what kind of research is done by an institution? Isn't it the student research and the faculty research? It's both, right?
I think honestly, Your Honor, they wanted to draw a line between supporting what would be, you and I would agree, is research and something that is simply fulfillment of ordinary course requirement.
Yeah, and that line is not drawn always between faculty and students. Students can and do many times in better institutions participate in scholarly research that inures to the benefit of the institution.
I can't argue with that.
But the guidelines, I just want to make sure I understand those. They do draw a distinction between students and faculty, right?
In the illustrations, they do, yes.
In the illustrations. Right,
but not in the term educational institution, unfortunately.
Right, but in the illustrations, they say a student who makes a request in furtherance of the completion of a course of instruction is carrying out an individual research goal. What is the status? What is the legal status of the guidelines here?
I think they are persuasive, no more than that.
Right. They're not law in this case.
They are not. They are not.
Are you done?
I think so.
I just have one question. Do you have any views about this severance issue and my reading of the order?
I agree with your reading of the order, Judge Dale.
Okay, because you call it, you didn't say that in the brief.
So no,
you,
but...
You agree it's a dismissal.
Of course.
Over which we have no jurisdiction.
Indeed, but okay. We've laid out our reasons why we don't think it's appealable, and why if it was appealable, it wasn't an abuse of discretion, and I have nothing more to add to what you said.
Can I, sorry, I do have one more question. Is there anything in the legislative history that would suggest drawing a line between faculty and students? I know there's the one line from Senator Leahy roping in faculty requests, but is there anything that you're aware of that excludes students?
I'm not aware of anything probative one way or the other from the legislative history on that, Judge Kennedy.
Okay, thank you. Council's out of time, right? Yeah, you can take 2 minutes.
Thank you. I only have...
And so on my question, on the $2, I'm sorry, the 2 hours, why didn't she just amend her request and say, okay, give me my 2 hours? Why are we here about this issue?
Because she was still insisting that she was entitled to an educational fee waiver. If she had amended the request, we could not have come and later argued the fee issue.
I see. Okay. Okay. Gotcha.
So I just have three very short points. Number one, both the court and opposing counsel used the term fee waiver. This is not a fee waiver. The limited pie issue does not apply here because this is not a fee waiver. This is a fee category where someone in the category still has to pay for duplications. Now, by DOD policy, they don't have to pay for electronic duplications, but that's not the same as a statutory fee waiver. And so that distinction does need to be made. The second issue is, as we pointed out, every other agency in every request that she has filed, except for the Department of Defense Inspector General's Office, accepted this letter, or in many cases, didn't even require the letter, treated her as an educational institution, including many DOD components. If the NSA is saying they're following the DOD guidelines, and four or five other DOD components, including the Office of the Secretary of Defense, say they're following the DOD guidelines, and they're recognizing her as an educational institution.
Are the responses of all the other agencies in the record?
I believe so, yes.
Sir. What do you mean you believe so? Yes or no?
They may not be in the record in this case because of the severance. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. But I do not know that for sure off the top of my head. And as to the non-perfection issue, the 2 hours issue, mm-hmm. it's not – can I have like 30 more seconds?
Sure.
It's not just that the statute is very clear that you get 2 hours and 100 pages. It's that both OIP and OGIS reached the same conclusion, and we gave those letters to the district judge and said, look, the two agencies that everybody recognizes are the FOIA experts in the executive branch said you get 2 free hours and 100 free pages if you're in all other, okay. Even if you don't commit to pay.
Okay. Could you?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
What about a student who's just making a request on his or her own to fulfill a course? Is that by an educational institution or is that not?
Ideally, yes, but at the very least, it would be all other. It would not be commercial. And by all other, it would get 2 hours and 100 free pages. And they didn't even do that. They just did not want to process these requests. They did not make the decision until 9 months after we'd already sued, almost 2 years after the request was filed. So whatever you can draw from that.
So, assuming it's okay with my two colleagues, could you tell us within 5 days cites to the other records where we can find the letters from the other agencies accepting the Jenkins letter?
Definitely. Okay. It may be in other case files, but I can definitely do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 5 days, okay?
The only one I cannot do that for are the agencies that we did not refile.
Whatever you have, just whatever you have.
I can just file copies of the letters with the court.
That'd be fine. Just give us a letter, whatever you want to do.
I can do that.
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted.